From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hello. Welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
My name is Noel.
They call me Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Cash a Credit Deccant. Most importantly, you are you. You are here, and that makes this stuff they don't want you to know. Now, we'll answer this question in a second, but we want you to think about this as well while you're listening. What was the last thing you purchased? Literally, well, the last thing you purchased before you turned on today's episode, did you use cash? Did you use a card or Ben Bucks? Or are you a person who still writes a check? If you said a card, in fact, if you're one of the people who just heard those questions and scoffed and thought, it's 2020, who on earth bothers with cash? Then congratulations, you're not alone. So what about us? If, as long as we're not, you know, confessing to anything illegal, what's the last thing you guys bought?
Was it drugs? It was drugs, wasn't it?
No, mine was going to be groceries. Quick story. I was at a Kroger, local grocer, and as soon as I've got about probably $100 more, maybe even than that, worth of food in my cart, I take it up to check out, and all of their network goes down. Yeah. And all I've got on me are cards. And I go, oh, well, I can't put this on the old corporate card anymore. I was really hoping to get away with it, and I would have if it wasn't for those darned kids.
Kids?
Yeah. Okay, anyway. So I ran across the street, and I got cash out, which I never do anymore, took it back over there, and by the time I got back, the network was up. So really, it's not a story. I didn't have to use my cash. Don't rob me. I'm not carrying it on my person.
But you did. So you ultimately ended up purchasing with a card.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No. It makes sense, though, because it's
like
a close
call. Yeah. Unless I'm traveling, and, you know, that's really the only time I'll take out a little bit of extra cash as a, like, maybe something will come up that I won't anticipate. Mm-hmm. But other than that, do you carry cash, guys?
I keep all my cash in my shoe.
All of it.
For a power move. For when I have to, like, give someone some cash, I pull it out of my shoe and see if they'll take it. That's actually from an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm. That's never happened to me.
And they'll take your shoe cash. Yeah, I used to carry cash in a couple of different parts of my person when I was traveling in sketchy areas. And then also when I am in cities and I use public transit a lot, it's just an old habit to always this may sound paranoid, but I'm sure I'm not alone in this. I strongly believe in not carrying all of your stuff like that in one area. You know what I mean? If you have something in your wallet, having 20 or 50 bucks in your shoe is also not as crazy as it sounds. You know, it's
Agreed.
A smart idea. This is interesting. Noel, what did you buy? Is there anything that pops to mind where, like, your last purchase or something?
With cash?
In general.
I went to the breakfast bar at Whole Foods this morning.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually paid using my Apple Pay on my phone, where you can just hold it up to the RFID reader, and then you put your fingerprint in, and then you put in your PIN, and you're done.
Wow.
And this, as long as these systems are in place, we see a lot of advantages for a cashless society, right? You don't have to haul around large amounts of bills. You don't have to worry about counting out or receiving change. It really can be, when everything works, as simple as putting your phone up to the RFID reader.
And it puts a level of difficulty between you and a potential person who's going to rob you, because they can't just take your card and then immediately use it. Generally, there's some steps you have to take.
Yeah. And again, in theory, right?
Yeah.
So that's today's question. What happens in a world where these sorts of interactions, Matt at the grocery store, Noel at the breakfast buffet, what happens when those cashless transactions are the norm? What happens when they're the mandate? Well, here are the facts. For anybody in the audience today who happens to be a dragon sitting atop a pile of cash, treasure, blood, and gold, don't worry just yet. cash is still king, as they say, at least for now. And that's because it represents, even today, the most frequent method of payment in the U.S. overall. That equals out to about 31% of all consumer transactions. And that's more than electronic transactions, credit cards, debit cards, or, of course, checks.
And that's yeah. worldwide, right? Or no, that's
U.S.-based.
That's just in the U.S.
Just in the U.S., 31%.
Such a surprising statistic to me.
The U.S. also lags behind some countries, which we'll explore a few examples in a moment. But this also makes me think, when's the last time you saw somebody write a check?
Who even takes checks anymore is my question.
The last time I saw a check or wrote a check, even interacted with a check, it was for a rental agreement.
That was what it was for me too, and I didn't have any checks.
So you had to go get checks.
I had to go get checks to write a check.
And they don't ever sell just one check unless you get like a cashier's check,
right? That's right.
I'm trying to think of other methods. I'm pretty sure some doctor's offices, like if you're paying a copay or something, will accept a check. And grocery stores.
They also both – have demographics that will tend to include older people.
Exactly.
It just seems – yeah, you're right, especially the older people. That's just more of like a, you know, old school way of paying that people don't want to fully phase out because it makes certain customers uncomfortable. They want to be able to do things the way they're used to being able to do things. Mm-hmm. But inherently, checks are a very inefficient means of paying because it takes a while for the money to come out of your account. There's the whole joke of don't cash this till Monday, you know. Like
checks in the mail.
Checks in the mail or aka I'm writing you a check that at this particular point in time isn't any good. Mm-hmm. That's a thing that is a sort of – a pitfall of check writing and accepting really more than anything.
But unlike credit cards, checks do not incur interest in that way. So that's one appeal people could see. Also, some people have the comfort, especially if they're locked into the technology, they have the comfort of physically writing out their ledger, balancing their checkbook, you know. For some people, that can feel the way that people of certain religions feel when they are handling rosaries. I say certain religions, but, you know, like Catholicism, I guess, would be the main one. I'm not a rosary surgeon or doctor.
I think there are more than just Catholicism.
Eastern Orthodox?
Yeah, I just know that that's one of them.
So
– was that the beads thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we see that despite the fact that so many transactions do still occur in cash, for a number of years, the United States and many, many other places have been moving away from physical currency. It's true. Fewer and fewer adults are using printed or minted U.S. currency, bills and coins, at all now. There are some people who are just like, well, why would I touch cash? It's dirty. It smells. We have some filthy statistics about physical currency in earlier episodes.
You don't like touching change, but how do you feel about cash?
I'm okay with it.
You're okay with it?
Yeah.
The tactileness of it all works for you?
Yeah. Okay. And thank you for checking, by the way.
I'm just making sure.
Yeah.
It's a lot more thong contact with the bills, though.
Thong contact?
That's what I'm there for.
Oh, you mean like in the club?
I'm assuming in the club. Okay. Or duck club, I guess.
Well, the thong is what you make of it, you know.
Well, you know, I keep my cash in my shoe. Some people keep cash in their thong.
Yeah. You might even have a little extra compartment maybe at a hip.
Wait, is a thong not a shoe? I thought we were talking
that's a type
about
of that. That's a type of flip-flop, yes.
Yeah.
The thong is a component of the flip-flop. I guess you could call them thongs.
Wait, so if
people say that?
Then what are we talking about?
Paul shrugs and says yes.
I was talking about underwear. I was talking about salacious undergarments.
Oh, wow.
Don't be coy. You knew what you were talking about.
I had no idea.
My mom keeps her cell phone in her brassiere. Is that weird?
A lot of people keep their stuff at knives, gas cards.
Probably bundles of cash.
Beepers, guns, bundles of cash.
What about the old money clip?
Drugs.
I want to see that make a comeback.
It's still around. Money clips are still around, as are money belts, which are like the nerdy pocket protectors you wear abroad.
Wait, so is that like a fanny pack exclusively for cash?
It doesn't have the carrying capacity of fanny packs. But yeah, most money belts will be worn under clothing and they will strap around like a fanny pack. Not all. You can get some cool ones. They're like a Docker. The word's probably not Docker's clutch, but you know what I'm talking about, the shoulder holsters for guns that you see in different detective films and works of fiction. This is interesting, though, to get back to this idea of few people using printed currency. According to the Pew Research Center, about 3 in 10 Americans said they go an entire week without touching cash at all. And that number has risen. In 2015, used to be a quarter of the population. But at the same time, the people who said that all or nearly all of their purchases were made using cash, the people who are the opposite of the cardholders, that number was 24% in 2015, and now it's fallen to 18%. And that trend seems set to continue. There's a lot of research going into this on the side of, surprise, the banking system.
And Facebook.
And Facebook, yes. Facebook wants to have its own currency.
Now check this out. In this survey of 2,000 Americans, U.S. Bank found that half, 50% of respondents said they carry cash with them less than half the time they're out. That makes sense. I can identify with that. I get it. When they do carry cash, 76% said they keep less than $50 on hand, and nearly 50% have less than $20 when they're walking around. And that, I think, makes a lot of sense when you're talking about the amount of money you get generally out of an ATM or something, which is, I would say, the primary way you get cash unless it's a gift or something.
Sure.
And those are generally, not always, going to be 20s. So I can imagine a 20 that you carry around because you might need it, or 40 maybe.
Mm-hmm. Your emergency stash, right?
Exactly.
If you're in a situation where you need to pay for a cash-only transaction, as we know, there are a lot of places, especially in larger cities, that are cash-only.
Yeah, right? And they won't take anything above a 20 a lot of times.
Right, right. That's absolutely true. We see a divided demographic. There are social implications to the cashless society because there are surprising divides between the way that we use currency, digital or physical, today, even before some weird sci-fi stuff. We know that there are clear demographic divides here. One of the first, which should not surprise anyone, is age. The second one should surprise people, but the first one is age. We know that the younger you are, the less likely you are to use cash.
Funny thing, I was actually at the courthouse the other day for jury duty. I was very lucky that I actually got selected to be on a jury, and the
you were case, lucky.
Well, you didn't get. I didn't get to the lucky.
Oh, okay, apologies.
I was selected to be on a jury, and the case wrapped in that same day.
Ah.
And I have to say, I actually quite once I made peace with the whole thing that I was going to be there, you know, until 7 o'clock at night, and knew that it was pretty much guaranteed to wrap that day. I really enjoyed the whole process. But in the cafeteria of the courthouse, they say 20s only accepted for purchases over a certain dollar amount, which was a very specific caveat that I'd never seen before for accepting 20s.
That's odd.
That's a weird
that
one.
That's really, really
yeah,
odd.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Yeah, I've seen that before, and then it's usually, I would say, rather than something nefarious, that typically is going to be due to the fact that the tills only have so much change they can make.
Right.
You know?
That
and
makes
they,
sense.
They probably can't go to a bank and get that cracked down to fives.
That makes sense.
And also how many people make a tiny purchase to break a 20 so that they can pay for parking or they can pay for some other related incident.
I didn't think about the parking deal because that's a big part of going to the courthouse is paying for parking. They don't validate it at the courthouse.
Yeah,
they definitely don't.
The benefits of citizenship do not go that far.
Nope.
So let's jump back to these demographics really fast.
I
want to hit on age, which again makes, I think, a lot of sense when you're thinking about this issue. So younger people, let's call them millennials, tend to ditch physical cash for, you know, stuff that you can do on your phone or things you can use virtually like credit, debit, digital payments, Apple Pay, Venmo, Zelle. Mm-hmm. It just goes on and on, PayPal. In fact, more than 1 in 10 millennials use this thing, their digital wallet, the thing on your phone that you probably have access to right now if you wanted. They use that for every purchase. And that is according to a separate report made by Experian.
Right. So that's not Pew Research anymore. That's Experian. Yeah. And we see that overall, 34%, let's call it one third, of adults under the age of 50 typically don't use cash. That's a crazy number. People over 50 years old, the number is much lower. Only 23% of people over 50 say, I've gone a whole week without using physical currency. But here is one of the distressing demographic divides. This is the one that should give us food for thought. We do see divisions along economic lines, along the lines of just straight income. It turns out that no matter who you are in the U.S., if you have an annual household income of over 75 grand, you are more than twice as likely to avoid using physical cash than someone who's making $30,000 or less per year. That, let's look at this a different way. Lower income adults in this country are four times as likely as higher income adults to say that they make all or almost all of their purchases with cold, hard scratch, cheddar. Pony bones is another one, right?
Do we have another one? Wasn't there pony bones? That's a good one. Wampum? That's not okay. I don't know.
Bread?
Bread's good. I like bread.
I want to bring back bread.
Ooh, yeah. Skrilla.
Skrilla's good.
You said scratch already, right?
Scratch
really,
is a great
really
one.
Dig scratch. Yeah.
Well, that's the cool thing. This quote out of context will sound strange. That's the cool thing about a capitalist society. You know, love it or hate it, people can use almost any term to describe money, and everyone else in the room will get it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get like 40 drax.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was a couple toe knuckles short on that, so I got the hamburger instead of the cheeseburger.
Yeah, it was. I couldn't believe they wanted me to spend 99 more sklounced to upgrade to that.
Are you tracking the sklounced? Yes, yeah, exactly. This is already a controversial topic, the idea of a world without physical currency, but it's only going to grow more controversial over the next few years, and we're going to see programming wars about it. This is going to be a hearts and minds conflict, especially in developed countries. There are experts out there who will tout the benefits of a cashless economy, and they have valid points. They'll say, well, it's more safe for people working in retail. The people who work at all-night convenience stores and have that sign that says we keep no more than X amount of dollars in the register and it's time released, we can't let you into the safe, that doesn't matter anymore.
Or are they going to stick people up with a thumb drive in the future and say transfer all of your digital money to me? That's going to make it a whole hell of a lot harder.
That
for sure.
Sounds sci-fi. But I'm pretty sure that's something that could happen. Those card readers, you can just put it in your cell phone. And if somebody has a gun and a friend has a cell phone with a card reader.
You're talking about square-based robberies?
Oh, yes. Robbing an individual.
That's what I'm talking about.
And taking them out of their pocket, holding them up and saying, swipe your – that's actually a really good point, Matt.
That happens a lot. That happens a lot.
Does it really? I've never heard reports of that, but it makes perfect sense.
People
that it
would. People getting robbed and forced to go to ATMs happens,
yes,
too.
Yes, you know, that
it's very common.
Happens.
But that's still a cash situation.
But it starts with the card.
It does, but you could argue that you could track the robbery if someone used their – Square
That's true.
Account.
And you can, but think about – so we have many people listening today who have found fraudulent charges on their cards. The bank will hopefully return that, refund it, whatever. But the person who did that, you know, who took that cash or usually made a purchase somewhere, they don't have to worry about it. They're gone. They've skedaddled to the horizon and are, you know, like capering around the pile of other stolen credit cards they have. But that – so we already see holes in the argument of safety, right? We also see, to the point you just made, Noel, we also see that there is an ease of tracking otherwise suspicious or occulted payments that exist in the gray, red, and black markets. For anybody wondering what the gray, red, and black markets are and what the difference is between them, the black market is all the illegal dark web stuff. The gray market would be things that are not inherently illegal, but maybe you skirt some of the regulations in a transaction. You know what I mean?
The red market is all about human trafficking. No,
yes.
I'm just kidding.
No, you're right. The red market is organ trade.
Okay, yeah. I thought we were going there, but I wasn't sure. I thought maybe Absolutely. You had something up your sleeve.
And check out our shows on the red market. And every show we do somehow touches on the black market at some point. But with this, we also see a lot of criticism. So just as there are proponents on the side of the concept of a cashless economy, there are vocal critics. And they're asking, could a truly cashless society just be another step along the path toward an all-powerful Orwellian dictatorship? Will this spell the end of financial privacy if such a thing still exists today, which is a different question? And then what will a world without cash mean? And what happens in a future where bills and coins literally just become collectible items, you know, like old stamps? Are the critics, in short, right to be concerned?
We'll learn about that right after a word from our sponsor.
Here's where it gets crazy. The short answer is absolutely. And it seems that both the proponents of this concept and the opponents of this concept are going to see their theories in action. The rubber will hit the road, and much sooner rather than later. In fact, the cashless society already exists in some places. It's much further along than we might like to think.
Right. So in Sweden, right now, only 1% of the economy operates on currency, on cash, on paper and coins. That is a tenth of the rate elsewhere in Europe. We know the Swedes are always up on the latest trends, so that makes sense. And they're really good at kind of streamlining things and making things pretty efficient. So it's interesting to see how it's working out there. And this is only 1/8 of the rate here in the United States of folks in areas that are going cashless. So the New York Times says that only about 1 in 10 Swedes paid for anything at all in cash in 2017.
That's amazing. Think about that. You are one of 10 people in Sweden. You meet up once a year and you say, what did you buy? Because you have weird Swedish parties. I don't know. That means that only one person in the room spent cash on anything.
You should call that number Ask a Swede and see if they bought anything with cash in 2017.
That's a great idea. Unfortunately, they pulled the number. You can no longer call a Swede.
Oh, that's a shame.
It is a shame. I had a lot of fun with that one, and I hate phone calls.
You actually called it?
Yeah, I called. Ask. Why not?
I just, you know, it's one of the things you talk about, but you never do. But Ben, you're a man of action.
Well, I spoke with a one time in particular that sticks out in my head. I spoke with a delightful retired lady, and it was a great experience. I hope she's doing well. I don't think she listens to the show.
So what are the big red flags, the big concerns about, you know, we always think of Sweden as everyone's happy and idyllic and living in, tiny homes or whatever and not spending cash. They seem happy.
They're rocking ABBA 24/7, right?
You know that's right. That has to be the only way. But what's the issue? If they seem like they like it, they seem like they have a good quality of life, where does it break down?
Yeah. Yeah, that's the $20 billion question, or $1, depending on how inflation works out. We have easily discernible concerns about a cashless economy, and no doubt in this show we will be preaching to the choir partially. First, we have to look back at what we've already proven. We have proven there is an inherent economic divide between the haves and the have-nots when it comes to cash. The less money you make, the more likely you are to use cash in general. That's a very broad brush, but so far everything we found proves that this is the case. This means that it is highly likely that a purely digital society could spell disaster for low-income residents, people who tend to use physical currency. So I'm going to introduce some jargon here, which is, I think, a little bit disturbing. There are a couple industry terms. One is unbanked and one is underbanked. They mean what they sound like. Underbanked means that there's a financial institution that says, hey, this person should be more included in our system. And unbanked means, I don't know how, but this joker is living under the table. They're only using cash for everything. They've deleted their Facebook, you know, et cetera, et cetera. It has these implications that if you are not participating in the financial system, you are either deprived or potentially dangerous. It's a little bit of a, what do you call it, Chomsky-esque, Bernays-esque packaging.
Well, we can see how that somewhat makes sense, especially if you think with my migration issues here mm-hmm. in the United States alone, like just residency, and if you are here by some means that is outside of the legal ways of staying here in the United States, then the only way to go is to not have a bank account and to use cash for everything. Because that if you were to get a bank account, your identity would be attached to it and you'd be found out.
It's the same as voter ID laws. There's arguments that that disenfranchises people mm-hmm. because it affects, you know, people that are in poverty who maybe can't get an ID or for whatever reason or living outside the law in some capacity.
Yeah.
Or never have enough money at any one time to keep in a bank so to the point where they're not being charged for not having enough money in the bank at all times.
Because let's not forget that is absolutely a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is so insane.
Paying for the privilege of getting your money out.
Future historians will take note of that, I would hope. On this point, we also see the problem of prerequisite paperwork, right? You want a bank account and you don't have proof of residency, one, maybe proof of identity, two, and it's similar to the voter ID stuff. This is a way, I know it feels like a strong word, but this is a way to potentially financially disenfranchise people. And then they are forced to work with the smaller and smaller slice of the financial pie that does allow cash dealing. Right now, there is a trend, the downward trend. Fewer and fewer people are quote-unquote unbanked or underbanked. But between 5 and 18% of people living in this country currently don't possess credit cards. And I would say, well done. You know, no judgment if you have one. They are useful, right, if you're responsible with them. But there are a lot of people who have very valid reasons that they don't want to interact with credit cards. And this leads us to the ultimate question regarding this first concern. Should potentially paying customers, be barred from stores or restaurants because they don't have, you know, an American Express or a Visa or a Discover or, of course, the last word in credit, a Diner's Club?
Ooh.
That's still a thing? Seems to have maybe gone the way of checks.
It's still around. Yeah. Surely Diner's Club is still around. Who wants to dine and not be in a club?
Is that similar to a AAA or is that
– I think the idea is that you subscribe to it and it gives you discounts at places that accept it or something.
Yeah. It was the first card really. It was like the first you would call it payment card company in history. I think now technically it's owned by Discover.
So, yeah, there you go.
So Diner's Club is no longer independent.
It's an institution though. You know, they want to hold on to that branding.
I watched one of the old commercials. You can still see them on YouTube.
Can we talk about something here, guys?
Yeah.
The concept of not using digital currencies or credit cards out of preference because somebody doesn't like it. Because my dad is one of those people where he very much will be carrying around cash on purpose to do everything he's going to do for that day or for that trip or that week. He will make all the purchases in cash and then he's done with it.
And that's tremendously convenient, right? Because then that makes a purchase stand alone.
Yes.
Right?
And his books are balanced because he did that one transaction of taking the cash out and he's
done. So this leads into the huge second concern, which is privacy. And this is a concern that should be in the forefront of everyone's mind. It's only becoming more important over time. Because like you said, Matt, many people who do not use credit cards avoid them out of preference rather than necessity. So do we start telling these people then that they must use these methods of payment while everyone knows very well that we're essentially making these people contribute to increasingly thorough and sophisticated profiles of their individual lives each and every time they make a purchase? And then do we just be Pollyanna about it, as Dan would say? Do we just sort of fiddle-dee-dee our way around the fact that this is one piece of a larger profile that may involve other aspects of your personal life? Do we ignore those implications? We cannot. We'll dive further into the rabbit hole after a word from our sponsors. We're back. Let's go a little further away from the light of what's proven and explore the shadows beyond, the things that could happen, that might happen, that haven't happened yet, or most distressingly, the things that may be happening now, despite the fact that no one's really talking about them on your local news affiliate. This is the first one. What if private financial powers are pushing cashless currency as a way to wrest control of money from the state?
Mm.
This may feel kind of small for some of us, but the fact of the matter is that historically, the ability to print money, the ability to be the person who determines the value of whatever these coupons or articles of faith may be, that ability, the sovereign creator, originator of currency, this power is something that is tremendously important to states. It's up there with having the ability to legally kill people. It's up there with having the ability to have a standing army, right? This is a life and death thing economically for a lot of state actors.
How do you pay for a standing army if you can't print your own currency? You got to rely on somebody else.
How do you maintain an army if you cannot be the one who determines the value of money? You know what I mean? So what if this becomes something where, let's say, the United States of America or Sweden, New Zealand, whatever place you want to name, what if there's a situation where a country's entire currency then becomes controlled by a consortium of financial powers or a single financial power? You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
What if Chase Manhattan one day decides to, you know, that they think Nigeria is a problem, so they just remove their access to that financial network, or they say, because we are the source, because we are the faucet through which this financial fluid flows, we will cut off the faucet.
And like, I mean, you could argue bad PR move, sure. Is it their right to do that? Yes.
If they control it, I mean, might makes right in this situation, you know, especially if they have the backing of other antagonistic state powers. And Nigeria rightly says, hey, we should be in charge of our currency. And then maybe Western powers say, nah, we talked to the folks at Chase Manhattan. We've got a pretty good case. We're going to make this a win-win for everyone, right?
It's weird. It reminds me of resource extraction problems in other countries, like with oil and the control of over oil fields, and whether it's a state-run thing or a privately run thing. And then what happens when somebody comes in and wants to control yours, like a foreign entity wants to come in and control your currency or the transactions at least that mm-hmm. occur in your country.
Mm-hmm.
Eesh.
I mean, and you know, evidence proves, I don't know why everybody is still pretending this is some sort of controversial or hot take. Evidence proves that the reason Western powers got involved in Libya and created regime change was entirely because the French government wanted to retain hegemonic control over the currency. And I'm not defending Muammar Gaddafi. I'm not picking a horse in the race. That's just what happened. And you can Google it, you can search it, because at this point the truth of that conflict does not matter.
To
the people who would censor it.
Yeah, of course. Maybe it's past the news cycle. It's whatever.
Right?
Yeah. And that went quick too. We talked about that for like 2 weeks.
Dusty tomes of currency and international trade. Why would you dedicate time to that, man? The Mandalorian season one is out, huh? Maybe if Baby Yoda was on currency, people would care more. Or the child, technically.
Speaking of currency and Baby Yoda, did you hear that Build-A-Bear is coming out with a Baby Yoda plushie?
No.
Those are going to fly off the shelves, man. That's going to become its own currency, I tell you. Mm. The kids, they love the Baby Yoda. You know who else loves the Baby Yoda?
Everyone.
Literally everyone else. It's
yeah.
true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, get your cashless wallets out.
Mm-hmm.
Start scanning them at the Build-A-Bear.
I mean, make no mistake, right? That's what people want you to do. That's what the people in control of the money want you to do. They want you to not spend cash to buy your Yoda Build-A-Bear.
Well, and funny, too, the language that even, like, you know, Apple uses in terms of the app on your phone that stores all your money and your cards that you can scan in. They call it a wallet.
Yeah.
Everyone's using that terminology because people are comfortable with that, you know. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, they're trying. It would behoove them to move away from a cashless economy. They want people to spend money online and have it be one-click purchases using your thumbprint, you know. Like, so you don't even have time to think about it.
Right. We do see some interesting psychology at play there. And this has moved, to be absolutely crystal clear, this has moved far beyond some kind of boardroom conversation or some professors of differing opinions arguing in a civil manner. The war for how you spend money, and it is turning into a war, this war has gone to the streets. If you live in the Western world, you have seen banks shutting down branches, shutting down ATMs, right? Automatic teller machines. They're not for nothing are they doing this. This is an attempt to push consumers into using those digital payment systems first and using that digital banking infrastructure because, again, there is tremendous power in owning the system. I would also say there's a profit motive. This isn't necessarily – this isn't inherently nefarious if you believe what the official statements of the banks say. There's a clear cost-cutting motive here because if you have a branch, you have to have staff. You have to have security. You have to pay these people, right? And if you replace them with a self-service app, you know, your banking app, you can check on your phone. You can just use that information to buy things. You can put your card number in your Amazon account and what have you.
You can take a picture of your check if you just got paid and it gets deposited. What?
That's pretty nuts, right? And you have to wonder about the technology there.
Yeah. Sorry, that blew my mind when I watched my wife do that. I went, you can – no, you can't. Take that to the bank right now.
I didn't believe it at first either. I think I had some security issues. But when you put everybody into a system like this, you're saving the executives of the banking institutions a ton of money, right? And that does translate to the bottom line. You're saving shareholders cash as well. You're also allowing in a way, you're allowing another revenue stream, a passive revenue stream. And you, the customer, by the way, you get nothing. It's a Willy Wonka moment, right?
Or it could be, we believe in nothing, Lebowski.
That's what I make. So that makes sense. And it's a business. There's nothing wrong with that. But also people need to be aware that your transactions – in an entirely electronic system, become another package that can be sold to data aggregators without anything other than your blanket approval because you didn't read the terms and conditions when you clicked.
What? Yeah. Who would do that? Who would not read the terms and conditions? literally everybody.
Yeah, I was going to say all of the employees who just lost all their jobs to the app.
Oh, boy.
But wait a minute, though. All these transactions are encrypted, right? I mean – what are they selling? They're selling just the contents? Like,
they're selling the
metadata? That makes sense. So you can't exactly tie it to an individual per se, but you can tie it to a demographic or
you could tie
a product
it to a lot of things.
Or, well, I wonder how it's used if it's anonymized in that way. Like how granular do you think that information gets for folks that buy it?
It's companies? Still evolving.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Think about how if you are an Apple iPhone user, depending on the model of iPhone you have, think about how if you spend time doing routine things, your phone, depending on the settings, will just start proposing alerts or alarms for you, right? That it's a similar reach into your brain. So banks did a Comcast move. Or Xfinity or whatever you want to call it. So there was when net neutrality was still a huge debate, Comcast was one of the companies lobbying intensely to remove net neutrality to be able to sell you an internet agreement the same way that you would agree to a cable package.
Yeah, like a la carte.
Mm-hmm.
Certain channels.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So you can pay for basic Google or Wikipedia, but then if you want to go visit something else, you have to pay the internet service provider. So, of course, it's a cash grab, obviously. But the main point, the reason I bring this up is that when asked about this, Comcast said things like, well, we talked to consumers and they want more choice. That's what we're giving them. We're giving them more choice.
That is such bull.
Well, guess what the banks are saying? Hey, all these customers, they want to do everything online. They want to do everything electronically. We're giving them what they want.
But that's such circular or like, you know, inherently flawed logic, is they're saying we're going to give you more choices by limiting your choices than selling you back the choices you originally had at an a la carte premium.
In the Comcast case, absolutely.
Yeah, and this one is just – they're just saying, hey, we'd rather do this the fast way through my phone or whatever than having to go to a bank, do mm-hmm. cash, do that kind of thing.
Well, think about it. Think about – the argument this way. Let's walk through it. The argument for the financial institutions is, hey, we're not saying people have to do this. We are reacting to what our customers want because we are very customer focused. You know, mm-hmm. we're here to make you guys happy. But what they're actually doing, if you look at the behaviors and you look at the policies in play, their activities conform much more closely to a concept from behavioral economics, which is called nudging. And we've talked about this a little bit when we talked about opting in or opting out on a driver to be an organ donor in a driver's license application. If people are automatically opted in, then they're much less likely to opt out. Also, shout out to a listener. You wrote to us and brought up a fantastic point. They said some people would be against being organ donors on their license because they genuinely believe that if they're in a traumatic injury and they're in a touch and go situation in a hospital and they are marked as an organ donor, then in some cases the medical professionals might just let them go or not try as hard to keep them
around. Yeah, shout out to Sterling for writing to us.
Yes, thank you so much, Sterling. That was a fantastic point. Nudging is like that. Let's say everybody does option A. It doesn't matter what option A is. It could be a burrito bowl. It could be paying with cash. You know, it could be what are those things that used to be on the front of pants? The little wrinkles,
pleats.
Pleats. Yes,
they're still around.
It could be pleated pants, option A. But you want, whatever business you are, you want people to do option B. People are more used to option A. They understand it. They get it. That burrito bowl makes sense to me. I like to pay with cash. I've always had these pants. What you do instead of saying you have to pay with a card or you have to order the quesadilla or you have to wear unpleated pants, you just make it slowly and slowly more difficult to get that burrito bowl. Now it's no longer on the menu. You can still order it, but you have to make it a custom order. You can still pay with cash, but you have to go to one certain line in the grocery store. You can still wear pleated pants, but they're not making any new ones.
You can see this at work if you've ever – this is odd. But if you've ever been on a turnpike or a road where you have to pay for the privilege – a toll road where you have to pay for the privilege to be on that road, where in a lot of the lanes, when I was a kid growing up, it was all you would pay cash to get through or money, sure. Basically, right? Then it became, well, you can pay cash or you can pay with a card of some sort. Well, then it became a system where you can pay to put a thing on your car that lets you run, like ride right through the toll. But generally, you could just – they had, I think, two lanes in a lot of places, especially on the Florida Turnpike, where you could use that special cashless system. But then everybody else got to go and pay. And then you kind of, over all the years, the cashless system began moving further and further to the right on the highway, where mm-hmm. all the lanes are then that. And then you can only really take one or two lanes to pay with cash.
Because the rest, it's essentially a subscription service. You're subscribing to the road.
Exactly.
And it's true.
Well, it's what you're doing with a card, really. You're subscribing to a company that is just going to cycle money for you.
You're subscribing to that sandbox. Yeah. Everything you buy or purchase use in that sandbox, their eyes are on it, which is not inherently bad. And also, to be completely fair, there is a great argument about how long it takes to make that shift. You know, you'd leave a lot of people out in the cold if you just turned everything cashless. Yes.
That's what we're saying, right? Eventually that sandbox gets so big that you don't get to play if you don't participate in it, mm-hmm. you know, because the sandbox takes up the entire playground and no more swings. This. It's all just yeah. sandbox.
Exactly. Exactly. And in that case, for this, if you had $1 million in cash in a cashless society, that doesn't matter until the moment you take that cash to a financial institution and they take that physical cash from you and they put some bleeps and some bloops in their computer system. And now you're a millionaire who can use their money. That's crazy. That is just – I get the logic behind it, but if you think about it, like explaining that to an extraterrestrial or to someone who's never heard of money, that sounds kind of arbitrary.
Is yeah. there an argument that this thing would also eliminate like some aspects of crime?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because, I mean, you know, the idea of money laundering is turning dirty cash into some other form or whatever, and if you can't – spend the cash in the first – I don't know. You know what I mean? Like it,
yeah.
Or, you know, again, drugs is a transactional cash economy in and of itself of scale. What happens then, you know?
Exactly.
And not that I know this personally, but I know a lot of drug dealers do take Venmo. That's yeah. that's a thing.
You just be mindful of the emoji you choose to use, right? So it's true. We should also say that cutting costs in addition to increasing government surveillance potential, which I think is what we're getting at, it also could save a lot of money for a government because now think about it. You can shut down the mint. You don't need to pay like in the U.S., we pay a quasi-public, I believe is the euphemism we use. We pay a quasi-public entity to create that stuff more or less out of nothing and then charge us for doing that. And now you're out of that. You're potentially out of that relationship. So you can save money on infrastructure. You can increase whatever you want to call your surveillance system, probably call it national defense or security, you know, something people will vote for. But let's get back to the nudge. How do we do this? There's a journalist named Brett Scott who wrote a great piece for The Guardian over in the UK. And Scott found a great real life example until I heard your anecdote about toll roads, Matt. This was my favorite one.
Is still my favorite one.
We just pulled the quote. This should hit anybody. This should hit at home if you've been to a grocery store.
And here's the quote from Brett Scott. We can illustrate this with the example of self-checkout tills at supermarkets. Yes, again, this is obviously the best example. The underlying agenda is to replace checkout staff with self-service machines to cut costs. But supermarkets have to convince their customers. They thus initially present self-checkout as a convenient alternative. When some people then use that alternative, the supermarket can cite that as evidence of a change in customer behavior and say, hey, this is Matt now. Hey, that's what they want, right? Back to the quote, which they then use to justify a reduction in checkout employees. This in turn makes it more inconvenient to use the checkout staff, which in turn makes customers more likely to use the machines. Then slowly they'll wean you off staff completely and nudge you, just gently, towards self-service. And that is certainly a thing that has been happening. And we can see it over the course, at least in the waves that have been coming over the past, what, decade?
For sure. I mean, and also think about how irrelevant the data they pull is. If you want something to sound like a good decision, sure, it's a good decision if you say 50%+ of our customers prefer self-checkout. But you can also say 8-10% of our customers immediately jumped on self-checkout, which is an indicator of a positive trend because it was zero. So it doesn't matter. The numbers don't really matter.
Well, and also, I mean, just the reality of having, let's say, 6 self-checkout lines or lanes available, whatever you want to call them, terminals, and you've only got 2 people on staff who are actually working in the supermarket checking people out.
Right. Now that's less you have to pay into insurance.
Well, yeah, it's all of that. But it's also if you're a customer standing there, you, even if you want to go and actually interact with a person and do it that way, it's going to move a lot slower. And you know it is just by the fact that there are only two of those versus six of these.
Right.
Right? So the line is going to move faster with the self-checkout. Anyway, I don't know. It's just there's so much psychology. I love that we're talking about this nudge in this way.
Yeah. I mean, to be completely clear, this is just one person's opinion, one person's perspective. I'm all about minimizing human contact. If I have a self-check, that's fine. You know what I mean? That's going into the data collection thing, which I know I've hobby-horsed about earlier. It's like when you call an automated line for your utility bill or something, and now because they want to gather vocal data on you, not because they hate you, but because they want to sell that to help increase the sophistication of voice recognition technology. I hate that. It's too much like talking to a person. Let me push one. Let me push one, then let me push four or nine or whatever and keep it moving.
I hear you. I think just – this is the last thing. I think primarily I'm just speaking to the number of people that are being put out of jobs through these – like Absolutely. Something like this and will continue to be put out of jobs and may not be able to find a suitable job for them anywhere else, because it's the kind of thing where you don't need to have a ton of education. There's a lot. Like, this is a good job. A supermarket.
It can be
checkout,
a career.
It can be a great job. And it's just one of those things that it's going away, like so many other positions on our planet. For someone who just didn't happen to go and get a degree in one field or another,
and
right?
drown in debt, right?
Yeah.
Well, here let's emphasize that too. I don't want to lose what you're saying. I think it's profound. We are moving, in theory, potentially, if everything works out, we're moving toward a post-work economy, the kind of the post-scarcity stuff you hear about in fictional universes like Star Trek. However, before we get there, even if we do a really kick-ass job of it, before we get to the post-work economy, we're going to walk through the dark woods of the post-worker economy.
Yeah.
Wherein people still have all the same human needs, but the system has changed such that the task we have to do to satisfy those needs, like having a job or participating in the coupon system, those options will be gone. And this is a real and a frightening thing.
You just got to watch ads all day.
Just have to watch ads all day, like in Black Mirror, right?
And your allocated funds have to go, you know, have to be spread out a certain amount every quarter.
And your blinks and attention are counted. Cover your cameras for peace.
Seriously.
I think I'm
the only one at this table here that doesn't have their camera covered.
I cover on my laptop. I cover one of the cameras with a sticker that says "Yay" because I'm trying to work on being a more positive person.
It really does say "Yay."
It's one day at a time, guys. So let's go back to Scott, because Scott also traces this purely to corporate profit. He says, quote, payments companies such as Visa and MasterCard want to increase the volume of digital payment services they sell, while banks want to cut cost. So it is a win-win for those two genre of entity. But he continues with a little bit of psychology about the nudge. And it's this. The nudge is it's a two-part con. Maybe that's unfair for me to call it that. It's a two-part process. If you want to call it a con, be my guest.
I didn't call it a con. That was you, man.
that was me. And again, that's we have to be very careful. That's one person's opinion. So first, the idea is that we increase the inconvenience of using cash, ATMs, and physical branches. We increase the barrier cost to it, right? It's harder to find one. Maybe the hours are more and more limited, and so on. And maybe fewer places accept cash, like Starbucks is starting to experiment with cashless shops and so on. So the second step is, it's not enough to make it a pain in the ass to do this stuff. To really sell the nudge, then we need to aggressively, almost militantly promote our chosen alternative, our chosen successor of behavior. We're making people learn that they want digital. We're presenting it to them as though it is their idea, right? And then they are functioning under the illusion that they have chosen it.
So, I am so glad I can use this now, and I got to be able to use this because the alternative was just so terrible.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, this – again, this is not inherently insidious. This is a profit motive, right? And for many people, at least according to the bank's research, for many people, this is the way they want to go.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
Agreed.
So let's look at the possible scenarios. Let's get real dystopian.
Yeah.
My favorite thing.
Right. So hold on to your yay stickers and so on. So let's say we live in cashless economy. It's anomalous. Paying with cash in this world is as unusual as seeing someone in the grocery store pay with a physical check.
Right.
And you're like, oh, this line's going to take forever now. Look, I got stuff to do. They're counting out nickels. What the hell? You know?
And then we have an escape from LA scale event that wipes out all electricity, all computer networks, everything. It's all gone. What do we do?
Right.
We start from scratch. We go back to conch shells and shiny rocks.
The barter system, right?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if that's where you're going, but that's certainly one – that's like the most dystopian version of this situation, I think.
And it could happen.
Oh, yeah. Well, it happened in Europe for about 12 hours, okay, back in June 2018 when Visa went down. Their systems went down. So that was pretty crazy, right? It's kind of like what happened with me that one time at the grocery store where just you can't make any transactions anymore. Oh, God, what do I do?
You immediately start looting is what you do.
Well, no. Yeah,
that's the only reasonable thing that you could do.
I would say first things first, ululate loudly.
Yeah.
And then take a knife and cut your forearm, not deep, just
enough.
Deep enough to bleed.
Yeah.
So they'll be like, well, this guy's not playing around. Look what he did to himself.
Drip it right on the glass scanner thing on the self-checkout. Smear it in the shape of a pentagram.
Yes.
And that'll be your payment.
And then loudly insist you were paying the blood price.
And then write a check.
So it is a thing that's happened before. In the case in Europe in 2018, people had cash. They had euro. They could fall back on that and say, well, that's a real pisser that my card doesn't work. I've got 10 euro or something.
Yeah.
But that didn't work for everybody because when the system was down, the same system that they would use to withdraw physical cash was also not functioning.
Right. Sorry. I feel like you buried the lead there a little bit, Ben. Ululate?
Yes. Yeah. Ululate.
Is that like –
Is that exactly what it is.
Just making sure.
The full image, it's ululation. Cut yourself a little, just enough to bleed. And,
drippity drip.
Yeah. Hold your arm horizontal, parallel to the floor, and then cut north to south. Don't ever cut east to west.
So, God.
It's good advice, Ben.
Thank you. Just for me, like cutting the body, the human body, even just talking about it in that way.
Yeah, it's not my favorite thing.
No. That's what I'm saying. Guys, imagine if you're in line at a grocery store and you see that happen.
Yeah, you're right.
Freaked out, right? But this is dystopia. This is the fall of society. This is not Visa going down for 12 hours.
So, okay, let's say that there was a digital-only system, right?
Yeah.
And the power goes out for an extended period of time, like a week, and there is no more cash. There is no way for people to trade cash. No one has access to cash. We've decided we don't use cash anymore, and we've got zero power. What happens? Right now, you would have your phones perhaps, right, or something, some electronic device that was charged enough during the initial stages.
Potentially, if you think ahead, you got a couple of those power bricks laying around that are charged.
Maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But think about that on a citywide scale, on, you know, if a whole city's power was out.
Oh, so what becomes currency then? Power? Stored energy? I don't know. I'm just asking.
I guess just what I'm saying is – it becomes a serious issue with a cashless society not to have something to fall back on in the case of an emergency.
Right. Well, we go to a barter system.
And it would have to be that.
And how long would it – it would depend on how long it lasts, right? Because the initial move would probably be to institute some sort of dealing on credit system. But if the records are gone, then, you know, it gets ugly real quick. Well, let's say that doesn't happen.
Okay.
Let's say somehow the house of digital cards remains steadfast despite the occasional drafts of wind. then we move into another problem. If this stuff works perfectly and nothing goes wrong in that front, we run into predictive profiles. So earlier we said they're collecting all this information as you move in and out of the sandbox. Now this is just one piece of you, right? We're, as Whitman said, we're vast. We contain multitudes. The financial footprint is just a single piece of you. But like your thumb, it's linked to the rest of your body overall. So assume this financial information gets linked with medical backgrounds, right? And DNA testing, your propensity for certain maybe disorders or certain manifestations of physical things. It gets tied to your employment history, right? It gets tied to your social affiliations because you're on social media. It gets tied maybe to you get flagged for controversial purchases like firearms, for instance, or maybe in another country where Planned Parenthood is illegal, you get tagged for paying for something that would be a contraceptive or, terminating a pregnancy.
And it also gets linked up with your Google travel information, where you've actually been in real time for the past X years that you've had that device.
Mm-hmm, your GPS, and it does go back.
Yeah.
The permanent record is real. And then let's say it gets linked to a criminal background, if someone has something like that. How far away are we from a world in which you can legally be detained before you commit any sort of crime just because there's a profile set against you and that this profile has reached something in its algorithm where it says, for instance, this person is now more than 50% likely to, let's say, default on a car loan.
I mean, they essentially already do that when making the calculus as to whether to give you the loan in the first place.
That's true. Let's link it to something scarier.
I'm agreeing with you. That same calculus could be applied to scarier things.
Right. So, like, let's say instead your financial information is linked with your medical background. And you are buying – we're just making this up. Your purchases are indicative of the nascent development of a medical condition that your background says runs in your family, and then your insurance gets pre-pulled.
Right.
Because they say, the stuff this person is buying is indicative of a very expensive thing that we don't want to pay for.
Right. And the legality of that in our society in America – I imagine is super gray, right? Because can't your insurance provider deny you for any pre-existing conditions? I mean, yeah. It's all self-reporting, I guess, but they can find out that you were lying and they could theoretically find out you were lying based on said algorithm and say, oh, we were just doing our due diligence. We had access to this information. What did you expect us to do? We're looking out for our interests.
Yep. And let's ignore the fact that life is a pre-existing condition. So maybe that's another episode, but you're absolutely right. The technology and the trends are there, even if we're not there yet as a species or as a society. There's one last one, which is an oldie but a goodie. It's the gritty reboot of using control of a currency as a weapon. And this happens all the time. We've read Confessions of an Economic Hitman, a fantastic book. Now it becomes more dystopian in an age of digital currency. Now that we're just trading ideas without any physical representation. One great example of this, which is still ridiculous to me, is remember when the Amazon Kindle came out, right? And people were like, oh, this is so convenient. I don't have to haul around tomes anymore.
And affordable. It was super affordable. That was a big part of it.
They were selling the tech at a loss, right? The way that Sony sold the PlayStation 3 and 4 at a loss because they were making money on the back end. I don't know.
On the cashless part?
Yes.
On the app store or whatever.
The transactions and the games. And I don't know why I did that weird voice, but it's true. So when the Kindle came out, tons and tons of people got this, and they got it as a gift for their relatives, the readers in their life. They got it for themselves, especially people who traveled a lot, so on and so on. But then, as reported by the New York Times, people found that some books, one book in particular, was being remotely wiped from their digital libraries. It didn't matter that they paid for it. It didn't matter that they possessed it as defined by their agreement with Amazon or the publisher. It just disappeared. So imagine now, take it one more step, and it's not a very large nor a very steep step. And let's say we are political activists or we are members of an oppressed community. I mean, vegans got tracked by the FBI for their diet, and they weren't doing anything disruptive. So perhaps this oppressed community we're in, let's say we're like the Uyghur population in Western China, and we're in increasingly open conflict with the state-level government. If we have physical currency, we can make non-approved purchases. We can buy maybe radio parts to create our own radio station, things like that. With digital currency, it is technologically feasible. We don't have a case of this happening yet, but it is technologically possible for a single entity to instantaneously erase all of the currency you possess. You have gone from a million to zero. I know that sounds crazy. One last detail there. The book that was removed from the Kindle, do you guys remember which one it was?
I don't.
It was George Orwell's 1984.
Ooh.
I think that's a nice thematic circle.
What are you saying? You're saying they removed it because they didn't want people to get wise to their scheme?
No, like, it was obviously a licensing issue.
It was only a publisher.
They only had it. They used to have it there for a certain amount of time, and they ran out of that period.
Are you kidding?
No, I don't know what happened. That's the only thing I can imagine.
I think it was a publishing thing.
Yeah, okay. They had to.
I don't think there's
You just think it's funny.
I think it's funny. Mm-hmm. I think it's gallows humor. I don't think they were Scooby-Doo enough to be like, oh, no, these pesky kids are going to find out about the threat of a surveillance state.
Oh, dear. Jessup, did you notice that almost all the Kindle purchasers are reading this 1984 hubblegull?
Dreadful. Dreadful. What's to be done?
I'm a bit worried they may begin thinking about their own situation.
No, we wouldn't want that, the hoi polloi.
Best just nip it in the bud, old bean.
Go ahead and wipe it. Wipe it all.
Tally-ho, now back to the meeting.
And pip-pip.
Yes. Yeah, that's a reenactment. We were reading quotes. That's a conversation.
That was an Illuminati boardroom conversation.
Yeah. At Amazon, weirdly enough.
Yeah, at Amazon. It's up to you to figure out what Jeff Bezos was doing. He is in those meetings, but I think it's mainly to bring coffee to those dudes.
There's an Illuminati lounge at most big corporations.
Yeah. We've got one. It's not as nice as I would like.
It's not here in Atlanta.
No. It's in New York.
Yeah, of course.
It's in New York. But it's like, come on, it's New York. You guys can get fresh bagels. You run the world. I don't know. They say it's a cost-cutting thing. It's for a different day. But this is where it leaves us, right? This story is not over. And parts of this story haven't happened yet, but it's quite possible they will. The trend toward digital currency continues. Cash still seems set to move along, right? When Kindles came out, a lot of people were making noise about the so-called death of the book. The book probably won't die because it is cost-effective and there are just so many of them out there. And they are also, unlike a Kindle or unlike electronic methods of reading, they are also very much air-gapped. You know what I mean? That's why burning books is still a thing. If you want to destroy the knowledge in books, you have to destroy every physical copy of it, or you have to destroy the knowledge of the language in which the book is written. And between the two, the former is much easier to accomplish, right?
Yeah. It is weird that they don't require any kind of battery or Wi-Fi connection.
Right. And you don't have to subscribe. You don't have to put your credit card info in.
I don't know. Books, man. That's weird. It's so old school.
So we know, and maybe that's just, I don't know, maybe that's a little too alarmist, but cash is probably not going to go away for some of the same reasons that books haven't gone away. Also, the move toward digital currency is supported, make no mistake, by very, very powerful forces, both in the private sectors, the financial sectors, but also in the public sectors too. If you want an authoritarian government, removing physical currency is a great step forward. There's an inarguable case of tremendous potential profit for those entities, that side of the argument. And the customers, most of the people listening today, you, yes, you specifically, the end user of currency and cash, you genuinely have very little say in this matter. Now, of course, the forces at play on the other side of the conversation, they will argue that the move to digital currency is a win-win for all parties. And those concerns we outlined are just that. They're sensationalist. They're fear-mongering. So ask yourself, do you believe their arguments? And if it turns out that even one of those disturbing possibilities outlined here becomes a reality, how would a society return from the precipice? Would there, in short, be a way to reverse the trend if it became clear that 80% of people hated this? And you know the way this game works. There's probably a human interest story that shows the dangerous implications. Let's say it goes viral and 80%, over half of the people who can protest this stuff start protesting it. Will it step back? Is there a way, or is it like Pandora's jar? One thing we know that's absolutely certain is this. When it comes to a cashless society, there are plenty of things out there the banks and your government do not want you to know, or at least there is stuff they don't want you to think about too long or too deeply until it's too late to turn back. I don't know. Maybe it's a rant. I don't know. What do you guys think?
You could turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know.
No, I think you're right on there, Ben. It feels as though we have to go mostly cashless. But I think the scariest thing is that last nudge towards fully cashless. Just because of those scenarios we built out there, everything right here towards the end of this episode, it does feel like a dangerous scenario of digitizing completely.
That for sure, the big picture dystopian kind of model and the fears there. But, you know, we have gotten to a place where even like, you know, a very small independent entrepreneur or like someone at a farmer's market, say, or a crafts fair can take a card when that used to be prohibitive. Now you got your squares and you just put it on your smartphone, but you're also paying for the privilege of getting paid. And that's a thing too. It sort of takes advantage of people, you know, for participating in this cashless system. Whereas if someone gives you cash, it's all yours. Or people are leaning now more towards Venmo because there's no fees associated with that for some reason, which is weird to me because I don't understand how they make money. There is a way where you can have – now there's a new feature on Venmo where to do that bank transfer and have
you
it
can
be
expedite.
Instant.
Yeah.
It's like a little, you know, negligible portion of the total amount. In the same way when you do a balance transfer on a credit card, they make their money on charging you a little small percentage of the overall amount.
They get a VIG.
So wait, let's say you're using Venmo. How long does it take for your drug dealer to get paid?
I worry about that. You know, drug dealers are some – you can be – it can be a very lonely life. You know.
I'm just putting this out there.
No, you get the money instantly, but you might maybe if you're a drug dealer or any other small entrepreneur who's getting paid with Venmo, you don't do the bank transfer right away. You do it all at once you've made a significant number of transactions,
right.
And then you do it all at once. You wouldn't get paid $20 for a marijuana cigarette, and then transfer that $20 right away. You'd wait until you'd sold, you know, several marijuana cigarettes.
Just putting this out there, I don't have Venmo. I've never used Venmo. I probably will never use Venmo.
I pay my rent with Venmo.
I feel like you're really high-roading me right now,
dude,
man.
No, I'm not high-roading anybody. I'm just telling you that Venmo is a giant informant. Venmo knows that all you're doing is buying and selling drugs, and every time you use it, you are talking about it to the person that you are selling or buying drugs to. I'm talking to you out there listening. Every time you do it, I have seen this occur.
What?
I have looked at it. You are literally putting evidence of drug dealings.
You are being so alarmist right
on
now.
On the internet. There's
evidence,
no record of that. No way.
There is. No, he's right. It's evidence of living in the moment, man. It's evidence of having a good time.
Okay. YOLO, I agree. But like, it's just so – it feels so short-sighted to actually pay for – just be careful, guys.
Sure.
Or just don't buy and sell drugs like
maybe me. It's short-sighted on the dealer side to get paid that way.
I don't know. I guess it works both ways because there's a transaction of both ends. There's a record of both ends of the transaction.
You are now a known associate of that person.
I suppose that's true.
We're all getting Kevin Baconed into prison, man. Ever since the post 9/11 society and the Patriot Act, you know, that's the way the NSA and the Alphabet Soup agencies vacuum up potential terrorists. It doesn't have to be your friend. It doesn't have to be your friend's friend. It could be your friend's friend's friend. I think it goes to 6 degrees of separation, actually.
Well, thank God they're more worried about terrorism than small, low-level drug deals.
Right now, you
don't know. That's the thing. You never. It could switch on you.
That stuff's going to be on record until. Oh, wait. Let me see. Apocalypse times.
So maybe just dummy it up, do some transactions and make you look like a great person. Donate some money to a cause that those authoritarians would agree with. But we want to know what you think. While this episode has ended, the show continues on and you are the most important part of the conversation. So find us and your fellow listeners on Instagram, on Facebook, on Twitter. We particularly like to recommend our Facebook community page, Here's Where It Gets Crazy. You can also find all or some of us as individuals on the internet. I am at Ben Bolin on Instagram. Tune in for some more strange adventures in the near future. And I'm at Ben Bolin HSW on Twitter.
You can find me exclusively on Instagram at HowNowNoelBrown.
You can find Matt on Venmo.
Yeah, all of Venmo. I'm just watching what you're doing and all the drugs you're buying.
Make sure to comment on all his transactions because that's a thing people do.
It really is.
Well, it's a feed, you know, so you can make little – you can't comment, but you can like them. It's very strange.
Make everything private to the best of your ability.
If you don't want to do any of that stuff, give us a call. Our number is 1-833-STDWYTK. Leave us a message. You might get on the show. At least we're going to hear it, and we really do appreciate your time doing that. We love hearing from you. If you don't want to do any of that, please – send us a good old-fashioned email. We are
conspiracy@iheartradio.com.
Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.